All righty, I think we'll get started. Thank you all for coming during nap time. You know, with the way we feed here, you know, I it's hard for me not to have a nap after Holden Village lunches or breakfast or dinner. But no, thanks for coming back. Some people may not have been in early session, so I'm just going to quickly review our objectives for this 5-session series. By the end of the 5 sessions, and even if you only come to one, you hopefully will get a deeper understanding of the need for immediate action in addressing the climate emergency. Recognize that such action will require fundamental and likely disruptive changes in how we lead our lives, individually, in our local communities, in politics, business, and the world at large, and come away more knowledgeable about the many possible life-affirming ways this can be accomplished, leading to a world even more whole, healthy, just, and connected. Up to now, we've been talking about the first 2 bullets, and there's certainly more to cover, but from this point forward, it really is going to be about specific solutions, the how. I want to start, because this is an issue, I want to read a little bit from an essay from a woman who has worked in the environmental movement. And I think it's important to hear this perspective, so just bear with me for a second. It's just about a 30-second read. Her name is Mary Anise Hegel. The title of her piece was, "I Work in the Environmental Movement, I Don't Care If You Recycle. Stop obsessing over your environmental sins. Fight the oil and gas industry instead." When people come to me and confess their green sins as if I were some sort of eco-nun, I want to tell them they're carrying the guilt of the oil and gas industry's crimes. That the weight of our sickly planet is too much for any one person to shoulder. And that blame paves the road to apathy, which can really seal our doom. But that doesn't mean we do nothing. Climate change is a vast and complicated problem, and that means the answer is complicated too. We need to let go of the idea that it's all of our individual faults. Then take on the collective responsibility of holding the true culprits accountable. In other words, we need to become many Davids against one big, bad Goliath. Particularly, I think it's important, I heard some either visual or verbal nods about the fact that, you know, blame is not going to get us anywhere. Right? It's going to, in fact, get in the way, because that leads to apathy. And apathy is the most dangerous response. So, let's talk about the 3 Ds. 3 Ds are decarbonization, distribution, and democratization. Each of those are strategies, clusters of strategies, that I believe are going to be the key to getting to that clean energy future that allows us to avoid the worst outcomes of climate change. A key piece underlying each of those is the notion that clean electrification is the entree, everything else is a side. Last session we talked about the fact that we do have the technologies to clean up the electric grid, replacing fossil fuel power plants with renewable energy, batteries, and other zero carbon sources. We could also clean up transportation with clean electrification by replacing gasoline and diesel vehicles with electric vehicles. And, you know, the rapidity with which the electrification of transportation is happening, we're right in the middle right now. That famous hockey stick that people look at around innovation, that electric vehicle adoption has been for so many years, and the last literally 18 months, that hockey stick is starting to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, it's starting in places like California. Yeah, California, you know, we are weird. But it's happening in other parts of the country also. But the third piece is buildings. It's one that's often not thought about. We need to clean up buildings by replacing gas furnaces and other appliances that run on fossil fuels with electric equivalents. In other words, electrify everything. So let's start with buildings. I'm sorry that this chart is probably too hard for you to read, but I'll point some things out. The easiest thing to do, if you want to do something to impact your particular emissions, is to replace your gas water heaters with electric heat pump water heaters. What this chart shows is what the yearly energy cost is. And by the way, on this gas list, this number was based on gas prices before the last 12, 18 months, the surge in gas prices, which are now three times what they were 2 years ago. So you could increase that number by at least double or triple in terms of your annual savings. Now, yes, the installed cost is less than either a high efficiency gas device or electric heat pumps. 850 versus 1660. These are national averages. They might be different in different places. In my community, my energy provider provided an incentive that made that price the same as a gas heater. I was able to do that. But part of the deal was, as I mentioned for those of you here earlier, that I connect my heat pump to the grid so that they could use my heat pump as a storage device, essentially. And they get benefit, I get $5 a month. Whatever. Now, what a lot of people will say is, oh, well, heat pumps won't work in my community because it's too cold. For those of you from the frozen north who say heat pumps won't work where I live, the highest uptake of heat pump technology is in Norway. And I bet you you're not as cold as Norway, right? Sweet. You can say you're as cold as Norway. But look at the countries that have the highest uptake, and they're also, by the way, their mean temperatures in January are the lowest. High efficiency heat pump technology is not the technology of 5 to 10 years ago. Technology today does work in these colder climates, both for heating water and for heating your home. And like I said, from a life cycle cost, they made the capital cost in the beginning, maybe a little bit more, but in 2 or 3 years, you're gonna make that money back. And oh, by the way, if you wanna get involved politically, get your utility to put out incentives for these programs so you don't have to pay as much. Now let's talk about cooking. This is the one that people get really emotional about. You know that statement about people not letting go of their guns over their dead body or whatever? There are cooks who say that about gas stoves, right? But the reality is, and, you know, do a little Google on this, the high-end chefs, the people who are sort of the class, you know, foodie-type people, they're all moving to induction, right? Now, induction is different than electric, right? Electric, you basically have a hot, you know, wire that's heated up by resistance on the wire. Induction is this sort of magic thing that I can't tell you, I don't understand, but it has to do with magnets. And the magnets, it's sort of like, you know, microwave heats up things. I don't think it's probably the same thing, but it's similarly magical, where something happens and it makes things hot. But the key point is, these things never get hot, so they're incredibly safe. That's one of the reasons. But more important is a chef can, if you are really, you know, a high-end cook, you want to know exactly how much heat to put on your food. Mm. You can get it down to a decimal point. And you can program it to say, I want it for this temperature, you know, 250 degrees for 3 minutes, and then 300 degrees for 5 minutes, and then cool it down.
Oh, man.
And it's done. And if you really want to have the flame, right, you really need to see that fire, they sell an induction stove that has these little blue lights that shine a little flame around your pot. Now, seriously, this is what we're talking about. I mean, come on, people. And people pay for that. I mean, but anyway, so again, and those of you here earlier heard the story about how gas stoves leak. That's bad for greenhouse gases because gas is 86 times the greenhouse gas impact of carbon dioxide. So if that stove is leaking, it's putting that methane into the environment. And oh, by the way, what about your health? So again, I'll make my message again. If you do have a gas stove, please put together a plan for going to induction eventually. Save up some money, whatever you have to do, but turn your fan on whenever you're in the kitchen. Because the air quality in your kitchen, believe me, is a lot worse than you think it is. Particularly when you turn the stove or the oven on. But even when it's not on, it's more likely than not that your stove is leaking. I told the story this morning about having mine inspected and learning that to my dismay. Oh, I was going to put a picture of the Holden Village induction stove, but then I found out that they bought the induction stove about 8 months ago. This is truth in advertising, okay? They bought an induction stove 8 months ago, and 3 days later it broke. And they had somebody come up to fix it. And he stayed for a week, but he couldn't fix it. He stayed because, hey, he liked it here. But there is one on order to replace it. So get a good warranty. I mean, you know, this doesn't happen everywhere, but that's why you don't see the stove here. Okay. Buildings, cows, and GHGs. Oh my. In fact, buildings account for 13% of all greenhouse gases. And ironically, this is the part that blows me away. Building the oil and gas infrastructure of the country, the actual infrastructure that moves gas and oil around, making the cement, accounts for 7 to 8% of all carbon dioxide emissions in the country. So not only are the emissions that are coming from burning fuel bad for us, the infrastructure itself, building itself, is bad for us. I'm sorry, 78% for the steel, 7% for cement, although cement is not just for the oil infrastructure. Cement is one of the worst. Now, there are people working on new types of cement that give us less greenhouse gases, but it's still pretty significant. And here's the one that I know some of you folks from Wisconsin involved in the dairy industry don't want to hear. At least a third of what accounts for agricultural emissions is enteric fermentation. Does anybody know what that means?
Cow pies.
Cow burps. Not farts. Cow burps. Because the way in which they process food. Now, again, University of California, Davis has come up with a new feedstock using seaweed, some people have heard of it, that reduces the cow burps by 50%. But 50% of something bad is still something bad. So, personal story, I know I throw these in here. About 2 years ago, I was at Thanksgiving with my brother. He's a pure vegetarian, actually he's vegan. But I was, you know, for both ethical moral reasons and climate reasons, because he doesn't, you know, like supporting cow burps. And I noticed that when he made his coffee every morning, he he was using those little plastic curry cups. I was like, dude, you know, you think of yourself as this, you know, purist, why are you doing curry cups? He said, well, it's easier to... I said, okay, I'll make a deal. I was going down this way anyway. You stop using curry cups, I'll stop eating beef. That was the deal. There's many ways to make change happen. That's what I'm trying to get at. I was going to stop eating beef anyway. I got him to stop doing the curry cups. And let me just say, for those of you who haven't tried it, you know, it's more expensive, but you don't have to eat as often. Buffalo meat is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Has anybody had buffalo burger? Yeah. Buffalo meatloaf? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's more expensive, just eat less. Yeah. You know, and you still get your meat fix. And buffalo don't burp. They have a different digestive process. So they don't give off the greenhouse gases. All right. This is the only thing you're probably going to remember, right? So let's move from decarbonization of buildings and food to the second D, which is distributed energy. And we talked earlier, there's my buddy, and I never got your name, I'm sorry.
Ben.
I'm sorry?
Ben.
We talked earlier about balancing the grid, but for those who weren't here, one of the key pieces about making this energy transition is when you have a very centralized power plant system with what's called baseload power, where it's just operating, it can operate all the time. And occasionally when you have more usage, say when AC use goes up in the afternoon, you can put on peaker plants and meet that load, but it's pretty easy to regulate. But the way the grid works is you have to keep things in balance. The usage and the power have to be pretty close together or things break apart, right? I'm not gonna go into the physics of it because I don't actually know it that well, but I know it enough to know you have to keep things balanced. Power going into the grid, power coming out of the grid, like water in a pipe, where the pipe will burst, right? And right now, the grid is organized mostly to take centralized sources and do that balancing on a regular basis. You've got your transmission grid, those big honking, you know, towers, right? That move big chunks of power around. It gets modified in terms of its voltage by these big substations. You see those things with the big boxes and wires and stuff. Then it goes into the distribution grid, and then there's little transformers that modify it again to be able to be used in your homes, your businesses, and so forth. Okay? That's how the grid is set up. And for most of the history, it's been a one-way system. Power goes from generating source through the grid to the usage. But now that people put solar on their roof, right? Or their buildings or their schools, power has to go two-way. And that makes it much more complicated. So, how do we manage that? We've got things called independent system operators, or ISOs. So you got a California ISO, you've got a Southern Power Pool, middle of the country, you got the MISO for this part of the country, PJM for the middle Atlantic states, Indiana, West Virginia, Virginia, New York ISO, New England, Ontario, etc. And other places have other arrangements that are not as large. And these ISOs are in charge of that balancing activity, right? They're responsible for making sure that all that power that's moving around is staying in balance in terms of the generation and the load. And they're operating on a 24/7 basis, and they have redundancy. So in California, we have the big ISO building up in Northern California, Sacramento, and we have done in Southern California. In case one goes down, the other one can back it up. And it's sort of very Star Trek-like. I mean, you can't sort of tell from that picture, but you go in there, and it's like huge room with screens everywhere watching what's going on with all the power. Very complicated process. Ironically, some of the biggest threats to the functioning of that overall system are symptoms of the climate emergency, right? wildfires and extreme heat events, and as we saw in Texas last year, polar vortexes, extreme cold events, stress the grid to the point where it could go down. And while it seems like, okay, well, that's inconvenient, whatever, but if you're in a heat dome, like you at the Northwest had, or frankly the Midwest has right now, and California has right now, where you have days and days of 100 degrees weather, and you don't have AC, people are going to die. I mean, people did die in the Northwest. This is going to be happening more and more often. This is the bad news part of this session. And with the polar vortex, which was a function of climate change, right? The extreme cold that came down from Canada into Texas, same thing, right? A lot of people didn't make it out. So this grid operation is a very essential function that we take for granted, right? When I was a strategy consultant, I was working with the Bay Area Rapid Transit System on a strategic plan. And one of the engineers said to me, you know, in thinking about the reliability of that transit system, he made a statement that has stuck with me, which is when big systems go down, when large systems go down, they go down big. It makes it hard to bring them back up.
Yeah, that happened to me down in Cincinnati.
Was last week.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, this quote here was last week.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm not sure exactly what the cause of that particular outage is. Sometimes it's not a climate event. My point is around the large systems perspective, which I'm leading up to, which is maybe we're still going to need the large systems, but maybe we need a higher proportion of local distributed energy systems to deal with the fact, or to protect us from the fact, that when large systems go down, they go down big. So, we need to move towards, in that respect, a grid that is designed to support what we call distributed generation, right? Again, not all or nothing, but one that is willing to have, or able to have, many more local sources of power, right? Because if you have these more contained sources of power, when the grid is stressed, it's not an all or nothing proposition, right? You don't have to shut down the grid because one area is particularly stressed, which the way it's set up now, that's the problem. If one area is particularly stressed because it's all interconnected, their grid operator has to shut it down, or there are going to be explosions and really bad stuff happens. But if we have the ability to take certain parts of that grid offline and still maintain power in other parts of that grid, we have a more reliable system, which, because of the risk of extreme heat, extreme cold, extreme weather events, we want to protect as many people as possible, right? We don't want to have those large systems go down. Is that making sense to people? Doesn't make sense to the investor-owned utilities, because they make less money that way. When you have that redundancy, that small system approach, they don't have to put as much capital into the large infrastructure. And as we discussed earlier, the way investor-owned utilities make money is not selling you power. That's a cost recovery model. They get to charge you what it costs them to purchase and give you power. Where they make their money is they get a guaranteed 10 to 11%, depending on the area. Some areas it's actually up to 14%. Guaranteed rate of return on all capital deployed. So they much rather build those big systems, those big wires, for $1 million here, $5 million there, where they get a 10% guaranteed rate of return, then enable a more redundant system where you don't need as much capital expenditure to have it operating. Because, oh, by the way, us as solar system, and whoever else has solar, has something called an inverter. That inverter serves a function of moving the power between the panel and his house. But guess what? To do that, it has to be able to regulate voltage and frequency. That's what the grid does, to stay in balance. There are utilities now, in Hawaii in particular, who are contracted with Oz's and other people's inverters to do the function of balancing the grid in a virtual power plant model at a significant lower cost to you, by the way, right? Because they chuck that 10% guaranteed rate of return, that capital they're spending on all that equipment, who do you think pays for that? That's built into your rates, right? So they don't like that he has that capability, and his neighbors, 20, 50, 100 neighbors, you aggregate that, those devices can regulate the grid, and essentially, it's a cost, because Oz is not going to give that away for free. He's going to charge you for that. But it's significantly less cost. So one story. Who was here when I talked about that Clovis school district that had the Tea Party chairman run the bond campaign? So, system's up and running. It's been there for 3 or 4 years. It's huge. It's 25 megawatts. That's a pretty big solar project in the particular area that it's at. And PG&E, the utility provider, announces one day that a $140 million grid upgrade project in that area that was going to go forward, so $140 million, which includes $14 million in profit, right, for them, 10% rate of return. Well, that $140 million, by the way, was going to go into the rates. They're going to cancel that project because of the growth of distributed energy in that area, including the 25 megawatts that we put into that Clovis school district. We actually put in solar in half the schools in that area, so it was more like 70 megawatts. So it was a big chunk. It eliminated the need for this transmission grid infrastructure. So you know that guy, the chairman of the Tea Party, you know, who's very money conscious? He reads about this in the paper. He said, so, Rick, so what they're saying is the money the school district spent, taxpayers, because it's a bond measure, taxpayers, spent to put in this solar is saving the rest of the community $140 million. What do you think he says to me? What do you think he asks? Where's my check? Is the school district going to get any of that money? That saving? Nope. So that's the political. That's the political piece, which is right now, the utilities in California have convinced the regulators that when projects are avoided, transmission grid projects are avoided, right? The people who invested the money that led to that possibility, now we're trying to change that. And there are these experiments where, you know, we're making this virtual power plant model more viable, but it's still, it's a battle that we're still in the middle of.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, see you later, Doc. Enjoy your t-shirt. We'll look forward to seeing it. Okay, I've talked about how the centralized model is really expensive. And here's the other piece, just to be clear. I mean, this just sort of shows. So one of the things that the centralized folks argue is, well, you know, you build a solar, okay, we'll build a solar power plant, you know, in the desert, and we could, because of economy of scale, produce power for 4 cents a kilowatt hour. But we're paying, you know, people, they're getting, that's the wholesale cost for exporting power to the grid from a home or a school. We're having to pay the retail cost, which is 8 cents, 9 cents. So it's more expensive. We shouldn't be promoting this home and school solar because it's more expensive, the power's more expensive. What they left out is those transmission costs. Nobody talks about that, right? They argue about how people who have solar in their homes and their businesses are putting costs onto other people, non-solar ratepayers, because their power is more expensive than the wholesale power. But they never talk about the transmission costs, right? Because that's handled in a different part of the system. So not only is the distributed model beneficial from that reliability standpoint, that redundancy standpoint, the big system standpoint, it's actually cheaper, net cheaper. I get emotional about this because, believe me, I spent a lot of time lobbying and arguing with people who don't, you know, around the stuff. It's hard. It's hard sometimes. All right. And oh, by the way, large systems are really dangerous. So I live in Sonoma County. You may have heard, you probably heard of the Paradise Fire that went through and destroyed. You forgot about the fire that happened the year before in Sonoma County, where 2,500 homes were burned down because of a faulty transmission line. And PG&E has been sued. Well, actually, they settled the civil lawsuit and paid people, including my friend who is a retired police commander who had to leave his home at 1 o'clock in the morning in his pajamas with his wife and arrived at my doorstep and lived with me for two months because his home was completely burned to the ground because of a faulty transmission wire, which was a piece of equipment that hadn't been inspected. Where did Don go? Hadn't been inspected in 20 years. Even though in the rates that they were given for cost recovery, they were required to do ongoing maintenance. So they were found criminally negligent. Nobody went to jail, of course. It was white collar crime, they never go to jail. But they did have to pay $21 billion. And so they declared bankruptcy, and the state figured out a way to bail them out. We're not going to go there, though. Don't feel too bad about that. All right. So the big systems are dangerous. Now, one of the solutions they're proposing is underground wires, right? Putting wires under the ground. $10 million a mile. Why do you think they want to do that? Why would the utilities want to put wires underground?
High infrastructure cost, 10% profit.
Yeah.
Can you say a little louder?
High infrastructure cost, 10% profit.
10% rate of return, guaranteed. Can you get 10% guaranteed rate of return on any of your investments?
But it would also help with the wildfire risk, right?
Sure, sure. But why should they get a 10% guaranteed rate of return on doing something to protect the public that if they'd done their maintenance properly, that they were paid for, they wouldn't have to do? That's why I get a little pissed. All right. So one of the things we're trying to do in California, and it looks pretty good, we last year funded about $300 million in what are called community/distributed resilience hubs. And what this involves is, this is not going to fix the fire risk issue, but one of the things we have in California now is called public safety power shutoffs. The acronym is PSPS. And what that stands for is when there is a high fire risk period, which frankly, it's all the time now, but when there is a particularly high fire risk period, temperatures are up, wind is high, the utility is authorized to shut down the grid, which, you know, protects us from the fire danger, because if the wire's not live, the tree falls on it, it's less likely to burn, right? But when the power goes out, what happens to those people who have medical equipment, who need power, who are vulnerable to heat, extreme heat, where do they go? What do? So we've got a plan, a model now, where we're going to fund community resilience hubs, meaning the schools where, you know, I put solar in 400 schools in California, 2,600 now have solar in California. About 20% have battery storage. Battery storage has different economics than solar, so it's not as easy to get them in there. This will provide funding to put battery storage in more schools so that when the grid goes down, you also have to put in something called a microgrid controller. Mm-hmm. When the grid goes down, that school and its gymnasium, which has AC, it has plug loads, it has refrigeration for medicines, can become a resilience center where people who are particularly vulnerable can go and, you know, either cool off for a few hours or actually stay overnight if necessary. So you will be seeing more and more of this model going out there in the next 5 to 10 years, I predict, because of all the dynamics about the grid and how that intersects with the climate changes. But, you know, those schools that have solar storage have it because the storage made sense economically. And I can get into it for those who are interested about why it is in some cases and some not others. But the schools that don't have that economics, they're going to need those incentives to pay for those. And California last year put $150 million. Right now, we're battling to get $1 billion into this program. Governor wants to put $300 million. Legislature wants to put $500 million. The various groups supporting us want to put in $1 billion. We'll see where it ends up. It's budget horse training time. So, again, we need both. We need the centralized grid. We also need these distributed models, okay? But what this chart shows is that with a mixed model, an ideal mixed model, over the next 25, 30 years, we can save net $120 billion by promoting this mixed model, meaning we continue to support distributed energy resources in the state. The problem is, and I alluded to this earlier, right now with the California's Public Utility Commission has a proposal that would essentially cut the value of home or school or business-based solar by 80%, as opposed to Florida, where the governor vetoed that bill. That's called, it's called net metering 3.0, is sort of the regulatory balance. So we're putting together these kinds of analyses to show that this is what you're giving up if you cut the value of home-based solar. We have 1.2 million solar projects on homes and businesses in California, and it continues to grow. That will go kajunk if this regulation goes through. And all the stuff I've just talked about in terms of the benefits of that mixed model go away. So this is why at the beginning, it's not just, and oh, by the way, I'm focusing on the governor, I'm focusing on the policymakers, but who do you think interests are being served? Right? It's the gas, it's the oil, it's the utility folks who want to get rid of distributed generation. Right, for all the reasons we've talked about. So don't feel guilty when you're not doing the greenest thing every day. Get involved. Now, the good news is, when this proposal first came out in December, and oh, by the way, the president of the CPUC resigned 2 weeks after the proposal came out, and where do you think she went to work? She didn't go to work for the investor-owned utility because they don't pay that much money. Mm-hmm. She went to work for the leading lobbying firm in Sacramento, mm-hmm. whose number two client is
PG&E.
PG&E. Mm-hmm. That's where she went to work after putting this proposal forward. That's allowed. Can you believe it? That's allowed. It blows my mind. But anyway, it's not. It's the money behind these policies. That's the problem. Okay. People don't, you know, these utilities, oil, gas, do not want to lose the cash cow. And so that's why they're paying to, with their lobbyists and everybody else, to keep these, to move these regulations forward, even though the science, the data, is clear. All right. Last D, democratization. In California, over the last 15 years or so, we've got something called community choice. Has anybody heard about or know about community choice? Okay. Oh, great. So community choice, I'll give a quick definition. It was first developed in Massachusetts, actually, but it's taken off in California, where communities, cities and counties in California, those are the jurisdictions, those specific political jurisdictions, can join together to pool or aggregate their electricity usage in order to purchase clean energy and develop distributed local projects on behalf of their residents and businesses. They work in partnership with the utility who still is responsible for the physical grid, but they take over the generation or purchase of power that they then sell to you. So they're purchasing or producing and selling the power to you. The first one came about in 2010 after an intense political battle that maybe I'll talk about when we talk about politics. In Marin County, you know, all those Marin County hippy-dippy types put the first one in. And now we have CCAs all throughout California. There's a CCA in every one of those green communities. And the yellows are one that are at the early stage. The oranges are almost there. And the others are sort of in between. But there are now 25 CCAs serving 25% of the California's population. They've taken away the actual procurement and sale of electricity from the investor-owned utilities. Okay? And again, they first fought that because, well, there's a cost recovery model for electricity, right? I said, and so presumably the utilities don't make any money off of that. They actually have a skim. And the way they skim it is they put into their model, into their cost recovery model, capital expenditures to support the sale, the purchase and sale of energy. And what do they get for those capital expenditures? Everybody, all at once.
10%.
Right. That's how they do it. So that's being taken away in these places where now 11 million Californians out of 40 are getting their electricity for community choice. And so these community choice agencies are public agencies. The boards of those agencies are elected officials from the communities being served. And oh, by the way, the impact is, and I know this is a small chart, a huge increase in the rate at which clean energy is being procured. They are procuring and delivering clean energy at a much, much higher rate than what is required under California's Renewable Portfolio Standard requirement for clean energy, and much greater than the utility at a cheaper cost. So in my house, I get power from Sonoma Clean Power. They're an agency that serves my county and the northern one of Mendocino County. My power is about, and I have, you have choices. You can do standard, mixed, or 100%, okay? My 100% power cost me 5% more than if I bought PG&E's best green power, which is only 50% clean energy. So I'm paying 5% for 50% more clean. Now, if I did the standard, which is 50% equivalent to the PG&E, my power cost would be 7% less than PG&E. Where does that money go? Why is PG&E rates so much higher? Where do you think that money goes?
Stockholders?
It's not stockholders. Yeah. It's that. When I first looked at it, I thought, well, but no, I'm still paying for all that capital expenditure profit stuff, right? Salaries. Public agency people make less than private company people. Pure and simple. It's salaries, advertising. And here's the quiz. What do you think the third biggest expenditure difference between a community choice agency and an investor-owned utility? I gave you a hint before. Remember that president who went to work for a lobbying company?
Lobbying.
Who pays for that? Lobbying. Right? So lobbying costs, it's called governmental affairs. Right? Governmental affairs is the line item in the PG&E budget. It's salaries, advertising, all that kind of stuff. That, because, you know, they're both buying power and producing power at the same market, right? But, again, we saw those charts earlier this morning, clean energy is cheaper. So that's the other reason our power from Sonoma Clean Power is cheaper, because they have a higher percentage of cheap power. Anyway. So this is a solution. You know, community choice is something that you could do in your community. There are other, there are other states where community choice is starting to bubble up. And people are, New Hampshire's got a community choice agency, Virginia's got a couple. I don't know about, I don't think Washington does, because most, a lot of your power is public power. And that, you get the benefits of having public power in that regard. Anyway, it's something to look at. And then the last, there's actually a fourth and fifth D, right? Determination, and again, I keep using disruptive. To get these, this is complicated stuff, right? We're doing a 45-minute class or a 5-session class. But it is complicated, but it's not. So let's go back to this net metering situation in California. When the proposal first came out last December, the political pros assumed, oh, this is just going to get rammed through. No problem. It's going to get rammed through. 30 days comment period. They'll vote on it. Tough noogies. Well, about 3 years ago, I'm involved in something called the California Solar and Storage Association, which is the industry trades group of small-scale solar folks. We decided we needed to, you know, there's a million, you know, 3 years ago there was a million solar projects in California. There's a lot of, you know, people who care about solar. We started an organization, a citizen-based, consumer-based organization called, our first name was Sunizens, like Sun Citizens. Didn't go over very well, got rid of that name, Solar Rights Alliance. And, you know, we got people to kind of join, and this, that, and the other. And, you know, we had about 5,000 members last fall. This decision comes out in December, and we do a big media blitz. By the end of the year, literally 2 weeks, we had 10,000 members. Those 10,000 members showed up, and they showed up at regulatory hearings. They called the governor's office. They sent letters. They went to the legislator's office. It was a mass grassroots effort. Okay, and oh, I think we're going to need governor. 2 days, even though the governor doesn't get to make this decision, he appoints the people to the commission. 2 days before the final decision was going to be voted on, he says, I think this is going to need a little work. A day later, the CPUC says, we're going to delay this decision. Right? They delayed it now 3 times. Because each time a new version comes out, 20,000 people are now part of the Solar Rights Alliance. Right? And that grassroots effort got their attention. And so why, when do you think, so let's see, November 5th is a date that somehow has meaning, right? What happens on November 5th?
Elections.
Election. When do you think this decision is going to be made?
November 6th.
So my prediction is we're not going to get a decision until after the midterms, because the governor doesn't want to have, you know, these pissed off people. We're growing 1,500 people every week, right? As the news gets out there, people realize what's at stake. Grassroots organizing, people being willing to be determined and disruptive can make a difference. This is one case example where, now, you know, story's not over. We'll see. But it really, it definitely made a difference in the short term. And that's what I have to say. So, questions, comments, reactions. No claps yet. Talk about where is this leaving you? You know, some of you have been here for all 3 sessions. What is this, what's the impact here been? I mean, you know, I'm up here waving my hands around. What are you getting from this? Yeah.
So overwhelmed with great information and realizing that it comes from your years of expertise, and I feel like, what am I going to do now when I go home and I don't have you in my living room to explain the complicated sides of these issues? Because there are things that sound like they make a lot of sense, but then as you pointed out, it's like, hey, there's a lot of other stuff going on.
That's right.
So I'm wondering if there's an agency, a nonprofit, or someone's place that you recommend for good information, or maybe if I don't have the ability or time do so much in-depth research to try to understand it, but I could trust the information coming from there, because that seems to be such a hard thing these days, is to really be able to trust the source.
Right. So I didn't pay her to ask this question. But this is the advertisement for session 5, which is called Taking Action. But even if you can't make session 5, if you sign up on, you know, my resource list, and I guess what I need you to do is tell me, if you've already signed up, tell me what state you're in, because it's different for different states. But I did this in October with a group of 60 people. They were from basically Minnesota and Montana. And so I had 2 states. And I put together a resource list for them, for those two areas. And people did some pretty cool stuff that I'll talk about on tomorrow afternoon. So yes, it's you're absolutely right. And again, you don't have to do everything.
Yeah.
Some of the people went away from that and they sent me notes and said, I got my heat pump water here. Mm-hmm. Great, right? I joined, you know, my local climate group. Great. I gave money to Earth Justice. Great. You know, you don't have to do it all.
Yeah.
But, you know, we talk about, what are the things that consultants talk about in terms of change, making change happen, is the 100 monkey principle. How many people have heard of that? Oh, good. So Jane Goodall, you've heard of Jane Goodall, right? Yeah. She studied chimpanzees. And she noticed something. She noticed this one monkey figured out that to get a snack, which for them is ants, that if you took a piece of grass and you stuck it down the ant hole, instead of just waiting there for the ants to come out, okay, I got a snack here, I got a snack there, if you stuck a piece of grass down there and lifted it up, you take that grass and oh my gosh, you got a dozen ants for your snack. And then she noticed, within a couple days, 2 of the chimpanzees were sticking grass down the hole. And then a couple weeks later, she noticed 10 monkeys were sticking grass down the hole. And then 1 week later, there were 20. And at the point at which they got to 100 monkeys, it only took a day for every single monkey within miles to be sticking grass down the hole. It's the critical mass. It's the viral, you know, now we have software, you know, viral stuff. It's the concept of things going viral, right? If you only think about your action in terms of the impact of that individual action, it can be a little discouraging. But if you recognize that, as you take that action, and you mention to somebody, I put in an induction stove. It's fantastic. I'm getting, you know, it's working. And, or you find a way to get an electric car sooner rather than later. Oh my God, you got to take a ride with me on my electric car. I already told Pat, he's driven in the car, but he hasn't driven it. Once you drive an electric car, you do not want to go back. It's too much fun. I mean, as just each little piece, we will go viral. This stuff, because it's good. It'll go viral because it's valuable. It's important. And oh, by the way, you're saving the planet. So don't worry about it being too complicated. Small steps are part of that viral process. That's got to keep remembering. Yeah.
So having been involved a little bit in a fight at Anchorage, as a local power plant, good news about public regulatory agencies is they're public.
Right.
The bad news is the whole system is designed to stay stable.
Right.
So how, for your group of consultants, how to keep a message simple enough for us to get behind?
Right.
Because there's so many words that come out to defend the status
quo.
It is really hard to see.
It's really hard. So let me tell you about an example. Maybe it'll be helpful. So this net meter proposal I said was, you know, it's going to reduce the value of solar exports by 80%, right? Which will make it hard for it to pencil for anybody. But one of the elements of that is a fee being put on solar users that basically being forced to pay for a fee for power that they use behind the meter. They don't export it. So let's say you get a more efficient, this is the way somebody put it to me. So they want to charge, if I was growing my own vegetables, they want to charge me to grow my own vegetables.
Yeah.
Right? That's what this fee is essentially doing. Power is not interacting with the grid at all. You're using it at home. They want to put a fee on that. So some smart marketing person came up with a short line. Don't tax the sun. That has been the rallying cry of these now 20,000 people who are going out there. So part of it is finding, taking the information and being able to boil it down to something that is, like you say, you can communicate in a very simple way. Why would we tax people for power that they're using for themselves? Why would we make people pay for vegetables that they're growing? Right? By the way, that vegetable one came from the daughter, like the sixth grade daughter of one of the people in the school group, my school energy coalition, who out of the mouths of babes, right? She said, Mom, that's like having to pay, she came up with it just like that. So you never know where the good idea is going to come from. You just got to stay in the game. Yeah.
Me and my little group come from a conservative part of Ohio, Warren County.
Yeah.
Ohio, by the way, used to be a purple state. It's now a red state. And
except for Sherrod Brown.
Except for Sherrod Brown, who's a great guy. We love him. But one of the things that I think we also underestimate is the importance of figuring out how to communicate to what had historically been organizations and people and political parties that are resistant to green ideas, green initiatives. Yeah. One of the ways we did it, and I belong to the Sierra Club, is figure out how to talk in terms that they like to emphasize and communicate it. Speak in their language.
Right.
Don't come in like, a green hippie, save the whales kind of person. They're just going to stop listening right off the bat. But if you talk to them in their own language, they will pay attention.
Yeah. I guess you weren't here for the story about the Tea Party chairman who I convinced to campaign for a solar project.
Yeah.
That's the same concept.
And she was asking for an example. So for example, the Republican Party in Ohio has been trying to pass all kinds of legislation to limit the choices of consumers and restrict what they can do on their own property.
Right.
Like they're not allowed.
Property rights.
Yes. So you say property rights, individual choice. I should be free. I should have the liberty to make my own choices on how to use my own land.
There's an organization in Texas, in Arizona called, it was there, but it's something about elephants and solar. I can't remember. Who take that very, liberty, independence. And by the way, the 20,000, we've polled them, 6,000 of those 20,000 are registered Republicans.
Yeah.
Right? And it's about choice.
My conservative,
now, there's certain choices they don't want you to have, but that one they want you to have, yeah.
My conservative neighbors saw me put up my solar array. They love it. They say, could you be independent from the grid? Could you be off the grid? I say, yeah, good if I wanted to. Yeah. They love it.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Don't assume that somebody can't be an ally, is the point. Because they may have an interest that you can connect to. And frankly, so it's so interesting. If you look at the poll numbers on who thought climate change was a problem 10 years ago versus today, right? Facts, Republican, traditionally people who did not have that, they're going up the curve because the facts on the ground are pretty clear. There's certain things you can't lie about. Yeah.
Sorry, I kind of rolled in here a little bit late. This is the first one of these I've attended.
Uh-huh.
But what inspired you to create a group and try to found something that was bigger than yourself?
My life story? No. In this particular case, we recognized that there was no way that if we just did the traditional lobbying thing, right, as a group of small distributed, and look, some of our members are big. We have Tesla's a member, right? We've got Sun Power's a member. We have some big companies with us, but our collective wealth, so to speak, and lobbying capability did come close to what the oil, other fossil, and utilities had in terms of money and power, right? So we recognized money was not, you know, we could do all the tech, you know, money raising, fundraising events in the world. We were not going to be able to compete. So that's why we basically said, let's use people power. We have millions of people in California who are benefiting from solar. Let's get them out. Let's make them, you know, making them aware of what's going on. Now, like I said, it took this crisis, you know, we were kind of bumping along, you know, we got to 5,000, but within 3-4 months, we got to 20,000 because of a crisis, right? You know the old adage, never waste. A good crisis.
A good crisis, good waste.
Yeah, don't let a good crisis go to waste. So that was part of how that occurred, yeah. I'm not saying manufacture crises. There are going to be plenty that are going to come without you manufacturing them. Anne-Marie.
Yeah, I wonder, are you giving out resources and recommendations for Ontario?
You put it on the list, I'll do the research.
Okay, number one, yeah. Number
and Ontario one. Actually historically has been pretty good.
I know, I am not, in particulars, I don't know, but
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the other thing, can you be too sane?
Can you be?
Can you be too sane?
Too sane?
Sane, S-A-N-E.
Yeah.
So, you know, for 5 winters, I have not used heat. And so I'm still thinking the little grass and monkey business,
yeah.
It's not taking.
There are certain innovations that may take longer for people to recognize. Okay. No question.
And it's really just a little bit inconvenient, you know, right. I don't suffer.
Right.
It's just a little blanket idea and, you know, it's never going below freezing.
Yeah.
So if I can do it in Ontario,
well, let's go back to the message. Are you telling people you could live without any heat? Right? That would be one message.
Yeah, I mean,
how is that going to sell?
Reduce consumption.
Right, I know. Reduce consumption. Okay. Do you say, let's compare our heating bills? Right?
That would be a motivator.
Yeah, I do. Like in my neighborhood, they give me statistics, and I'm usually between 50 and 80 kilowatts. My neighborhood is between 500
and... No, I'm not talking about kilowatts. I'm talking about money. Pull out your bill, what you actually pay.
Yeah.
And compare that to your neighbor's bill.
Yes, yeah, no. I mean,
you have done that.
It's not amazingly more.
Oh, okay. Well, then I guess Ontario has a lot of hydro. Your power is pretty cheap.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So that may be a place where it's harder to make that case, but maybe there are other issues where it could be.
That's true.
Yeah.
But to your point, I'll pull out my electric bill and show it to my neighbor, and my electric bill is zero.
Right.
And his electric bill.
But you have your true up though at the end of the year.
Sorry.
Don't you have a true up at the end of the year? Oh, you don't have a true up.
I don't know how.
Okay. Anyway, keep going.
It's literally so I pay nothing for power. And he pays $250 a month.
Right.
So again, you can motivate people with the right message.
Right. Motivate people with the right message. Okay, what I think we're getting close. Oh, we're past. I'm glad to stay here and have some more conversation. I got nothing else to do this afternoon, so please feel free to leave if you want to leave. But I hope you come back tomorrow, because tomorrow we're going to really dig down into political strategy that the young woman up here was talking about. We really get into policy and political strategy a little more in depth. Before Thursday afternoon, when we're going to really talk about taking action. Now, I have lots of really good ideas for how to do that. So, anyway. Please sign up, put your state, so I know what version to send you.